Woo, time to pull up a chair and talk some Dynasty football. I am your host, JJ Wenner, and this is the Ride or Dynasty podcast presented by Gridiron Ratings. Tonight, we're going to dive into some auction draft strategy. With me is my co-host, Dynasty Guru, and podcast host for SGPN Fantasy, a true Dynasty dork, Dave Heilman. How are you doing, sir?
Doing fantastic. Looking forward to hearing about the auction draft tips from Drew. And appreciate being on here, JJ.
Absolutely, my brother. Finally, pulling up a chair for the first time on the Rod Pod is a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He writes for the Football Guys. He's the host of the auction brief for Fighting Chance Fantasy. He's the reigning two-time champ of the King's Classic Auction Draft, a criminal defense attorney, a husband, a father. You can find him on TikTok at Fantasy Football Lawyer and on Twitter at Drew Davenport FF, the Honorable Drew Davenport. How are you doing, sir?
Good, good. I don't know if I deserve the honorable part, but yes, I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
We are so happy to have you on, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite a while. Before we jump into the episode, we are giving away an autographed DeAndre Swift jersey. All you need to do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Once we hit 100 reviews, we will draw a winner. Look in our show notes for the link that you need. And as always, please do all of your typical YouTube and podcast things. Like, subscribe, follow, leave a comment. It helps us grow and provide you with the content you are looking for. Now, lately, we've been jumping right into the main topic, but with the recent NFL news, Dave is going to jump in to talk about Baker. Dave, what is going on?
Yeah, we finally got the Baker Mayfield news we've been looking for. We haven't got the final verdict on whether Deshaun Watson is going to be suspended or not. Would love to hear that take from Drew. And I think it closes the door on Jimmy Garoppolo to Carolina, possibly, and it opens up the door for maybe Jimmy Garoppolo to Cleveland, or, you know, obviously we got to see what's going on with the Watson situation, but I do think it is an upgrade for the weapons over there. I don't know if it's a huge upgrade, but I think it is an upgrade over there if Baker gets the start.
Drew, what does this do for you looking at the Panthers' weapons?
Well, you know, I was a little bit surprised that my take today was not the norm. We were having an internal discussion over at Football Guys about what this does. And there was actually quite a bit of disagreement about how much of an upgrade and whether this is an upgrade. My take was pretty instant. Like, hey, I've been waiting for Mayfield to go somewhere. I think it's a significant upgrade. I'm not saying that all of a sudden these guys are all top 12 or top six or whatever. I just think it's an upgrade, and I don't know how we could see otherwise, but I'm finding out that is not necessarily a super popular opinion. I do think that DJ Moore is going to benefit from it. I think Robbie Anderson is going to benefit. Just think the offense as a whole. I mean, Sam Darnold threw like 9 touchdown passes last year. It's got to be an upgrade.
It has to be an upgrade. It has to be, right? I mean, yeah. Sam Darnold is listen, the Jets drafted him. I'm a Jets fan. I always have some type of affinity towards Jets, but he was terrible. And I was so happy when Joe Douglas got anything in return for him. But man, I just don't see how Baker doesn't bump up all of those weapons. Dave, have you seen anything else? Are people doubting?
Yeah, I mean, I think the compensation for Baker is kind of throwing some people off a little bit, but they're not understanding the salary implications of this. Baker's a lame duck quarterback on a contract that, you know, the Carolina Panthers or whoever was going to pick him up was going to have to make a decision to give him an extension next year. You know, the money that he had, Cleveland did agree to keep some of that, which was a big part of the negotiations. But yeah, I mean, people look at last year, it's a very recency bias, what have you done for me lately kind of a league. And they forget how good Baker Mayfield was in 2020. So I do some concerns with the Carolina offensive line. It's not as good as, you know, as it, you know, was in Cleveland for him. But, Yeah, I'm with Drew. I think it is an upgrade. I think it's not going to be a camp battle. Baker's going to be the guy, and he gets Cleveland week one.
That will be a game to watch.
JJ, can I add something real quick there?
Absolutely.
Because I think that any time we have the conversation about the camp battle, they've already come out today spinning. Oh, no, Darnold's looked great. This is going to be a battle. He's made great strides. They're saying that to make him feel better. And honestly, that's what they should do. And that's what teams need to be better at doing. But Mayfield's going to win this job, number one. And number two, the compensation thing, Dave makes a great point, because I've heard that several times today. Well, they only got – that has nothing to do with how the Panthers saw his value. It has to do with the fact that the Browns had zero leverage. My buddy Brian Drake has been on this for a month. They have no leverage. The compensation has nothing to do with their expectation for him to start.
Yeah, 100%. Don't be fooled by what people trade for players. I mean, that's a whole different topic of conversation. By the way, Scott Kobe says that he only plays in auction because of you, Drew. He commented.
Scott's a big supporter. I like Scott. How's it going, buddy?
All right. Well, if we don't have, we can move on from Baker a little bit. And on to the main topic. Now, I love listening to your poker stories, Drew. I don't know how many people say that to you. I say it to you because I honestly think. Well, there you go. So I love when you share the stories because of how you tie them back into fantasy. You don't just go off and tell a poker story. It always ties back into how can we get better as a player. What do you find is the biggest parallel between the two? Fantasy and poker.
Well, that's an excellent question. When I'm in an auction draft room, my ability to read people and their tendencies is the biggest parallel I have. But I also believe that in general, when you learn better decision-making, and I think that that's all poker is, there are a series of decisions that you make every hand and they pile on top of each other. And I've always said that I think people underestimate. They think, okay, well, I'm going to learn this one thing and I'm going to win all the time. Well, it's not really like that. You get fractions of a point better. You get 0.5% or a 0.3% edge or a 1% edge by doing these little things, and you stack them on top of each other. That's exactly what poker is, and that's what fantasy football is. If you ignore certain parts of the equation, you're going to have big leaks in your game. Poker is one of those games that's just going to pound on you. And I think fantasy is the same way. It just pounds on you if you make little tiny mistakes. So once you eliminate those little leaks and you tighten up your game a little bit, it's not that you're going to win all the time. It's that you're not going to make the mistakes that leak that expected value. I talk about it. JJ, I think you listened to my show a little bit, but I talk about expected value over the long term of making these decisions. And I believe that we have these leaks that just leak away at our positive expected value long-term. Now, maybe it's long-term, you're going to win 11% of your fantasy leagues. Well, why wouldn't you want that to be 13 or 14% by just eliminating these small mistakes? And poker's the same way. It's a leaky bucket. It will leak if you don't take care of it.
The thing that amazes me most, I was able to watch you in an auction talk to you immediately after the auction. How are you able, and I'll say this about poker, it's something I don't have. It's the ability to be so present in the situation. How is that a skill you have developed? Is it something you were born with?
It's a little bit of both. So let me say this. My buddy who gets to listen to this all the time, he gets to listen to the stuff behind the scenes when I'm complaining about this or that with fantasy or poker. He calls me a sick individual all the time. I think that's part of it. I think I have this just insane desire to get better. And I just can't stand it when I'm not like the best I can be. And I know that sounds funny. Like my wife's going to listen to this and be like, hey, you know, you could help with the kids more. That would make you better. but I just like when I get into poker and I get into fantasy and I think, well, I could do something and it would make me better. It drives me nuts not to do that thing. So to circle back around to the point, when I'm in an auction, it will haunt me if I make a mistake because I wasn't paying attention or because I wasn't present or because I got a text and I looked down and then all of a sudden they're saying going once, going twice, and it's a deal I wanted. Like, that stuff drives me crazy. So yes, I think you have to be born with it a little bit, because I know that that competitive spirit is really innate and there's nothing I can do about that. But you can also work on it. You can work on training your brain. And one of the things I say all the time is it's a muscle and you just have to train it. And if you say, I'm going to work on these three things this year in my auction drafts, you're going to get better at those three things. And maybe not your entire game is going to be rounded out in one season of drafting. But every time you go in, if you get better, you can train yourself to handle these things better and be more present.
It's like an athlete. You don't expect, like, an athlete doesn't say, oh, I'm going to work on a low post move today, and now I'm going to bust it out in a game tomorrow.
Right.
It's something that you, right, like, you can't just make a change for one draft and think that next year you're going to be amazing at it. Right. It's something that you, and much like poker, you do it over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the one thing about poker that people always ask me, because I sit there. So I used to be an online grinder and I would play 4, 5, 6 tables at once. So I got to the point where, like, I was bored. Like, I'd have a movie on if I had less than 4 tables. Like, okay, I got 3 tables. This is boring. And I'd be watching a movie while I'm playing. So when I'm sitting at the table now in a live tournament, I got to have headphones on. I got to be looking at Twitter, because I get bored at the action. But that's because I did it 30,000 times when I was playing. Those repetitions don't come easy in auction drafts. So you just got to do as many as you can. And I don't mean like mock auctions. I think real mock auctions are one thing, like the kind that Adam Siegel's doing. And I'm going to do a couple this summer also. But you can't really get in a mock auction room and get the reps. You just have to do as many auctions as you can. And then hopefully somebody like me, if I'm talking about them, I can short circuit the learning process a little bit, so you don't need 30,000 reps, you know.
But that was the biggest change in poker, when online tournaments became like, so all of a sudden you had those old pros, right, who would sit at the table, like the Fergusons, like all the Brunsons, who had just grinded out of tables one tournament at a time. And then these new kids came in who were playing, like you said, 20 tournaments at a time.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just,
It's wild, because when you really do the math and think about how many hands you actually play in a live tournament versus playing online, it's disgusting. I mean, the tournament that I play in regularly, they have automatic shufflers. So we get a lot of hands in for a live tournament. But when you really think about it, let's say that you, in order to play in a tournament like that, you have to devote 3 to 4 to 5 hours to winning money in that tournament. If I was grinding online, I could play 15 tournaments in 2.5 hours, whereas I can play 1 in 5 hours live. Think about that. If you play 3 times a week, which is a lot, most people don't, and you're playing 100, let's say you're playing 150 tournaments a year, I was getting that in a week. So you just, the reps are just, there's no substitute for getting the reps in.
No substitute. So now you are hosting a poker tournament at the Expo this year.
Yes, sir.
What was the genesis of that event?
Honestly, man, I was sitting around one night and seeing all this cool stuff happening at the Expo. And I thought, boy, there is a nice little slot Friday afternoon to do something like having a poker tournament. I thought, why not? I get so much good feedback from my poker stories on my show, which has surprised me. Because when I started telling them, I was just like, this is kind of fun. I can just run my mouth about it a little bit. But when I started drawing the parallels, people really enjoyed it. And I thought, well, gosh, there's a lot of people out there who play fantasy and play poker. There's a significant overlap there. This sounds like a great idea. And as soon as I pitched it to Bob, he was on in 1 second, said, yeah, let's do it. And I told Joe and said, hey, Joe, what do you, Joe Bryan over at Football Guys. Mm-hmm. I said, Joe, what do you think about this? And he said, well, I'll tell you what, he liked it so much. He said, I want to be exclusive sponsor, and let's run with it. So we're getting a bracelet every year. Hopefully it's going to be a yearly thing. It's going to be a World Series of Poker style bracelet engraved with, you know, Expo Football Guys Poker Tournament Champ. So
now, based on your poker prowess, do you feel any particular pressure to win this tournament?
I do. It's going to be weird, because I've got, my wife said, just bring your buddy along. My buddy who plays a bunch, have him run the tournament. She said, you're just not going to be able to play. And she's right to an extent. I'm going to be doing drawings for free for door prizes, for And I'm going to have to be moving people table to table and mediating disputes and all that stuff. It's going to be difficult. But yes, I do feel some pressure there. Absolutely, 100%, especially because I post about it on Twitter. I know people have an expectation that I'm a good player. The thing is, I think I'm a solid player. I don't necessarily think I'm that great of a player. I think I'm just very solid. I'm not going to make a bunch of mistakes, never going to give away my chips, but I have a lot to learn. And I think there's going to be some really strong players in there. Dwayne McFarlane, Howard Bender, Mike Randall, a couple of these guys. I think there's going to be some really strong players. I think it's going to be a big mix, to be real honest. There's 60 players. I think we're going to have at least half good players. But then there's going to be a lot of people who are weekend players who I certainly hope that I can outlast some of them. I just want to make a good showing. Get me in the top 15 or 20 and I'll feel all right.
Well, I'll be honest. I didn't sign up only because I was intimidated. I'm barely a once a year player.
Okay.
But if you need any help doing the drawings and things like that, I'll be there. Yeah.
All right.
I'm more than willing to help in any way.
I might take you up on that because I'm going to be moving people, putting them at tables, drawing, doing all the stuff and trying to play at the same time. So I might take you up on that.
You let me know. And I know that there are prizes for the winners. We talked about the bracelet. Have you considered any punishments for the first fantasy analyst eliminated?
I haven't. You know, that's a good idea. You know, what I did consider at one point was doing a bounty type thing where some of the analysts, some of the more popular analysts like Dwayne and Howard would have a bounty on them. The problem is the budget's getting a little tight and I've dropped that idea because I'm actually giving away door prizes for people who aren't in the tournament or are in the tournament, like both. You can win either way. But the point being, one of the things we talked about with the legality of the tournament was we can't just run straight up a poker tournament for cash and here you go. We have to have an event. Mm-hmm. And so we're not making any money on this. We're having food and we're having music. And so it's going to be an event. So yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. Now, something that you hit on your last pod that I particularly enjoyed, you went back and hit some of the basic setup questions. You called them the mechanics, right? The auction mechanics. I enjoy that because something that I noticed as a podcast host, content creator, is that we often start from a place of implied knowledge. We assume the people listening to us know what we know and understand what we're about to say. Now, as an English teacher, the most difficult part of teaching literature for me is ensuring that my students have the background knowledge they need to understand the text we're about to tackle. We do a story about a girl and her abuela, and they run into a situation at a Catholic mass. The first year I taught it, I got no reactions from the class. And it's a great story. And then I found out none of them were Catholic and none of them go to church. So how the hell would they know anything about, right, the climax of the story? Because they didn't understand it.
Yeah.
So going back to the basics of auctions, if you were setting up an auction league, right, you commission a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
What are your basic settings of your preferred league? Is it Superflex, 1QB, PPR? What do you look for?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I do. I'm a commissioner in two leagues, and I'm in three. I had a say in some of the settings in the third league because it just came about 7 years ago, and I've been the auctioneer there too. So I got to be honest. They might take away my analyst card, but I'm not a super flex guy. It's not that I don't like it. It's just that it's not something that I'm as interested in as people. I think that there's a prevailing opinion out there that everybody's into Superflex now, and I really don't think that's the case because I've tried to go Superflex in a couple different leagues. People just don't want it. I frankly am not that excited about it either because I think it has the effect of swinging the pendulum from one side to the other, where quarterbacks are just far too important. And then you're just, it's all quarterback and nothing else. I find that to be less interesting. So I'm one QB guy. I'm not into tight end premium, but one thing that I've done is we do PPR, but one thing I've done is I've really pushed for all my leagues to go to what I call full flex. And that would be you're only required to start one of every position. So in my home league, you only have to start one running back and one wide receiver, one of everything. And then you can start four flexes, and they cannot be quarterbacks. So you end up going a lot deeper into different strategies. And I love that for the auction because it makes things really unpredictable in the auction. But also during the season, it really gives you a lot more flexibility that if you don't have that stud running back or whatever, you're not out of the game. So I really believe in the full flex. I'm pushing for that harder and harder, and a lot of the leagues I'm in are doing that.
I love that concept. In a league, one of the leagues I commission, it's start one of each position. It is super flex. It is tight end premium because I'm into all the crazy stuff. But everything else is a flex. You have to have, I think it's like 9 starters, and the rest. It's also best ball, which makes it a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I do a best ball league as well, but it's super flex. And that's why I started it, was because I wanted to do a little bit of both.
Now, have you ever done an IDP auction?
I have not. So I've had people knocking down my door to do IDP for a few years. I just don't know that I'm ever going to do it. It's not that I think that I wouldn't enjoy it. In fact, I think I probably would. I'm spread. My mental headspace is, you know, I was talking to Ryan Hallam earlier, and he says, oh, man, you didn't get in Big Brother a fantasy. And I said, honestly, like, it would have taken 5 seconds to draft a team, and I don't have to follow it. He keeps track of it all. But I said, it's just the mental headspace. It just gets so crowded in here in June, July, and August. I just can't do it. So I'm out on IDP, and I think probably in perpetuity.
I think I might try to start an IDP auction because I think that would be insane.
I think you should do it. Absolutely. I encourage people to do whatever. Here's the thing. Like you said, you do tight end premium, super flex, whatever people are into. Just enjoy it. These are the settings I like. Do whatever you like. Get into whatever you like.
Well, the question that I have, so if you're trying to encourage someone to get into auction and new, what are some basic settings that are, you know, to help with a newer group?
With a newer group, I wouldn't be going at the full flex thing. I'd be going one QB straight up the middle, PPR, start 3 wide receivers, start 2 running backs, because that really helps to cement values in the room. I know going into some of these full flex leagues, like how that's going to swing the values. But for beginners, you don't want that. You just want things to be as set as possible. They're going to begin to learn how those values play off of each other in a much faster way.
And what kind of budget are we looking at? And, you know, we'll say a basic, you know, basic format where there's, like you said, pretty basic lineup, not a huge bench.
So you want to know what I think about, like, exact prices or how I build a budget or what?
Like, I'm trying to think of it more like a salary cap, but like in the league settings, what's the, like, what do we have?
Oh, okay.
What do you have to spend?
Yeah, it's standard is $200. Now I have a couple leagues. It's weird. One of them's the one that I run is $270 cap, which is a holdover from rotisserie baseball. It used to be $260 for rotisserie baseball. I was in those leagues long time ago when I was in like 8th grade, and then my buddy started a fantasy league with the 260. We ended up with 270 when we expanded the rosters. That's super weird. 200 standard. I've seen 300 in places. I run one that's 300, but yeah, 200 standard.
So in redraft and keeper auction leagues, an issue that most leagues encounter is how do you keep teams active who are out of the chase? One league that I'm in allows you to trade future auction dollars. Do you have an opinion on that? Like, do you allow that in the leagues you commission?
I don't. So I'll be honest with you. I don't have an opposition to that idea at all. To be real frank, some of the rules that I have in my leagues are based on the fact that it's too much record keeping. I got one league that's significantly more complicated than any league that I'm in other than the Kitchen Sink League. And I got to keep track of salaries and then contract limits and things like that year to year. And we usually have some turnover because it's a weird kind of league. So I generally make rules that make the record keeping easier on me. That sounds terrible, but I'm going to admit it. But so you're talking about keeping people in to when they're eliminated later in the year?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I like a couple different things. I instituted something in my leagues. I love this question, by the way, because I never get these questions. And I have a lot of these things that I have to think about as a commissioner. So I instituted something a couple years ago in one of my leagues. It's called participation points. And I know that it's going to sound a little bit weird to start, but it's actually been very, very helpful. So I came up with some categories of things that you could do on the website, and it takes less than 10 minutes a week. If you just log in one time, you could do all these things like voting in polls. The polls are generally like funny videos or questions about fantasy, post on the message board. There's a spot on MFL. I don't know if you guys play on MFL, but there's a spot where the coaches quote on the previews every week. You can click on the coaches quote. You can write your own quote in there. So you can bet that's fun. Like everybody does their coaches quote and talks trash. So less than 10 minutes a week, you can log in once a week and do all these things. It makes people come to the site and then they say, all right, I got to do these things. But then when they're on there, they find that they're having a good time. It seems like a chore at first, but then they're having a good time. And then what you earn is you earn a couple extra auction dollars for the next year. So I like that. And I also like we pay weekly high points, and we also have a loser's bracket where there's a punishment. So our punishment, we have a couple different punishments, but the big one is that you have to get a magnet that goes on the back of your car that says, I suck at fantasy football. And you got to have that on until the next draft. So, you know, we have a Hall of Fame where you can earn points towards getting in the Hall of Fame, and you get a jacket, stuff like that. So all that stuff pulls people through. But specifically to your question about trading auction dollars, I don't think that's a bad idea. But I tend to think that in redraft leagues, I don't want there to be carryover year to year. I want everyone starting out with the same auction dollars unless you earn a couple bucks. Like when they earn participation points, the max you can earn is $5 on your cap. So I'm not trying to tip the balance of the league. I like the reset in a redraft situation completely. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, that was because I guess my issue is because I'm against it only because it's up to $50 on a $200 budget. So we're going into next year, and now there's teams with $250 and teams with $150. And it just seems like it's really throwing off. And personally, right, because it's a personal thing. It's I'm in the league. It's throwing off my strategy.
Yeah. It's hard to come up with a strategy when things are that unbalanced to start. And I just don't like that you can load up like that much. I think that there needs to be a better limit there, because that's a quarter of your cap that you can pull out. And that's a whole, like a $50 player is a top of the line player. So you're going to
have that's serious like a inflation. Bottom end RB1.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about gosh, I just think that's too much, but that's my opinion. And again, I want people to be happy playing what they like. But I think in a redraft auction, that tilts the balance too much.
Michael Corrigan, I hope you're listening to this. He's my commissioner. Looking at you, Mike.
Come on, man.
Yeah. Sometimes great ideas don't have to be completely thrown out, but you got to massage them to where it makes sense. And, you know, and if you're looking at a 25% increase of your budget or whatever, that's quite a bit. And specifically talking about like keeper leagues or dynasty leagues, what are some things that you can do in an auction format to prevent tanking and things like that? Because you're always going to have rebuilders and stuff like that. But, you know, it's pretty frustrating when you're trying to make the playoffs and you got Drew needs to lose this week. And I look over and JJ's got, I won't name any names, but maybe Sam Darnold at quarterback. And I'm like, okay, he's just letting Drew have this one.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I stress in my leagues is that if you're not starting a full lineup in a reasonable lineup, then as the commissioner, one thing I did about 10 years ago was something that I think has worked out really well. I sort of Roger Goodell'd myself, and I said, I'm going to do what's good for the league. And if people are doing weird stuff that isn't good for the league, then they're just not going to play in my league anymore. And so I've gotten to the point about 10 years later now that I don't have much of those shenanigans anymore, because the people in my league understand I don't put up with it. And I go back to something that somebody said a long time ago. I forget who it was. It was a former Supreme Court justice when he was talking about a decision he made about pornography. And he made the famous comment, "I know it when I see it." Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's how I feel about fantasy football. So if I am in a keeper league or I'm in a dynasty league, I know when you're tanking and I can see when you're tanking. Now, it's one thing if you had 13 injuries and you're starting Sam Darnold. It's another thing if you've traded away everybody on your roster and that's your only guy left. We can see it. We know when we see it. And that takes a strong commissioner. And part of the problem with that is it's difficult to be a strong commissioner because a lot of the people in the league, you know them, you like them, you want to be nice. But I think this comes from being a lawyer. Like, you just have to have bright line rules. Like here are the rules. And, hey, by the way, I'm a commissioner who's – you agreed to join this league because you believe that I have the best interests of the league in mind. If you think I'm going to be poor at it, don't join the league. Otherwise, I'm going to do what's best for the league. I think everybody's going to mostly be on board with that, except for the person who occasionally I might have to rule against. But I really haven't had a lot of problems. And I know that sounds weird because that's not a great answer. But I think maybe calling your league and telling them, hey, this is what I expect and this is what a fun league is all about. Then you have it set up where when the league ends or the season ends and they've done something like that, you say, hey, look, I gave you the heads up that this isn't what this league's about. So we're going to move on and you know, best of luck. But that's hard to do.
Yeah, the name I was searching for was Tyree Jackson. Someone had Tyree Jackson at quarterback, and I was like, really?
Yeah. Really? See, again, that's obvious. Yeah. Like, come on. Yeah. Like, what are we doing here? And it's not fun. And by the way, do you want to win that way? And again, it takes a different kind of person. Some people will say, no, yeah, I don't care. I want to. But then you're not going to be in my league. Sounds harsh, but I like the people in my leagues, and I'm not going to just let them walk all over the process.
And you're also not, you know, as a commissioner, you know, I always try to think of it. I only commission four leagues, but I always try to look at, I'm not being mean to one person. I'm being good to 11.
Right.
Like, I'm trying to be good to the league as a whole and ensure that it can last by making good decisions. Now, going back to a conversation that we had just before, how... You are the auctioneer of how many of your leagues?
I do it for three. It was three. I only do three.
Okay. So last year, I remember after the Kings Classic, you and I had a conversation. You were like, oh, what were your observations? And I remember looking at you and being like, oh, shit. Because I didn't remember anything. Like, I didn't remember anything that happened in that auction because all I was focused on is remembering who the player was, what the current bid was. And then I'd forget the player name and I'd have to turn to Ryan and be like, oh, him. Okay. And he would always get me back on track. How are you able to be an auctioneer of a league and have the bandwidth to participate in the auction itself?
Well, it's hard. So the short answer is a lot of practice. It's reps again. Because I started out in a league where I was not the auctioneer, and I got to learn in that league for a couple of years before I had my own league. And believe it or not, I started my own league as a snake for about 2 years, and then we switched to auction. But I've been doing it for a long time, and that doesn't answer the question very well, because at the beginning, how did I do it? I think what it comes down to is I've always felt like a bit of a sick human, that I'm as prepared as I am when I go into these auctions, but that's how I've reconciled it. I know when the person calls out that player, I know whether or not I'm after them. I know whether or not they're going to fit on my team. I know what kind of price point I want. So I know all that information almost instantly. And this is what I would say about poker. When I'm sitting at a table and there's the guy sitting back there with the sunglasses, and every time it gets on him, he acts like he's on the World Series of Poker and he's on camera and he's like, look, it's like, no, 99% of your decisions should be rote decisions. Those should be decisions that you just know how to make. And I believe that in an auction. I believe that when you're prepared, most of your decisions are very easy. There are going to be moments where you're like, do I bid $1 more? Or, should I really go for this guy? Because it's kind of switching things up. There's going to be those moments. And I'll be honest with you, there have been moments over the years where I've been sitting there and can't decide whether or not to bid. And the bid, you know, my cadence runs out and, you know, I couldn't, but I don't think that it's as difficult as it comes back to getting the reps, and then as you do it more and more, it's like the divided attention thing with poker when I was playing five tables. When I'm in an auction, I've done it enough that that muscle is, it's a reflex now. And I can just kind of say, all right, mix in for 46, going once. And I'm not even hearing myself say mix in for 46. I'm looking at my sheet to know whether or not I can bid 47. So it's just, the divided attention thing is you have to practice that.
So talking about practicing that, and you know, we always tell everybody mock, like mock draft until, you know, you can't mock draft anymore, because you don't want to get into round seven of your draft and go, oh, this is not how I thought this was going to go.
Right.
So where can you mock for auction drafts?
That's a great question, because it is hard. And I can distinctly remember, and not to call anybody out by name, I'm not going to do that, but I was in a mock with some analysts that are very well known a couple years ago, and they treated the mock kind of like a joke, where they just went for a bunch of high level players and then they were kind of done. And I ended up with this like incredibly stacked team. And I was like, everybody look at this. I wish we could play this out, but they didn't care because they were just doing a mock. And for them, it was just like, they wanted to get five good players and then they were done.
Uh-huh.
So that frustrates me. So my point in telling you that story is just, it's hard. It's hard to find good mocks. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you can jump in a random mock auction on ESPN and have it be any use. So I would say, don't do that. The first thing I'd tell you is it's better to not do a mock than to do one of those crappy ones, because it gives you a false sense of security. A couple people are just going to pay like $80 for two guys and they're going to log out, and you're just going to get everyone else way cheaper than you should. So go ahead.
No. So do you do any videos yourself of, you know, mocks or even live that they could use as an example?
Yeah. So what I would tell you is seek out Adam Siegel on Twitter. And if you want to, I think his Twitter handle, I think he changed it to Always Auctions. So seek him out. He does mocks every week. Now, I believe they're Superflex, but he's doing once a week. Nice. Those are going to be very reliable mocks. You're going to be able to get your feet wet for $0 and figure out how to do it. So I think those are great. I'm going to do a few. And to answer your question, I actually did last summer something that was very popular. I'm going to do it again. When I had a mock going with some industry folks, Dave Richard and a couple guys like that, I just went live on YouTube and said, I'm going to just spitball, see how this goes. And I just ran my mouth for 2 hours about what was happening in the auction. It was incredibly popular because people really wanted to see like what was my thought process on certain things. Yeah. So I'm going to do that again this summer. I haven't set a date for it yet, but I'm definitely going to be doing that.
Definitely let us know. I'm looking forward to watching that and probably hitting up Adam Siegel and trying to participate.
Yeah, just, you know, just do it, because it's zero stress, zero pressure. They don't publicize the results and make fun of people. Like, it's a bunch of good dudes, and you're going to get real experience.
Yep.
Now, so most people are hesitant to join an auction draft. I love auction drafts. The reason I love auction drafts, and I know you would ask last season, you would always ask people to, at the end of your pod, which do they prefer? And I like auction drafts because you get rid of the people who just rely on the ADP, who just pick the next person up in list. And it always pisses me off when I see, like, when I run, like in my sleeper leagues, like I always turn off like the ADP button so that the players aren't sorted by ADP, just because I hate when people who aren't prepared benefit from the site itself telling them who to take. And that's something you don't have in an auction, because you actually have to go after players. I don't know if there was a question there except me wanting to say that.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I would say is that you are going to have a little bit of that on auction sites, because now Yahoo and ESPN publish their own prices. So sometimes unprepared players online are going to get the benefit of some of that, but live, it completely destroys any of that, unless they're printing off my average auction values or something before they go to the draft. That's going to help them a little bit. But auctions are so weird. And I say this all the time. I know everyone knows that auctions aren't predictable, but the number of people that come to me and say, what percentage of this and how much did this guy cost? It's amazing. And that those aren't bad questions. It's just that it's really hard to give you a definitive answer on that because every room's going to be different. You're going to go in the room and be like, well, that isn't at all what he said. Well, every room's going to change based on league settings and personalities in the room. It's really hard to do that, but I'm with you 100%. It drives me nuts when I know a person's unprepared. I was in my home league last year. Both of my brothers are in it. My one brother works his butt off, tries, a very good auction player. The other guy is just kind of in it because his brothers are in it and love him to death. He's my brother, but he's not necessarily the most savvy auction drafter. But I got into a situation, and I told this on the pod this week that's coming out, preview. But it's I was down to 18 bucks, and he had 18 bucks, and I wanted Deontay Johnson. It was the only impact player left on the board. So I went into a shell and said, I got to save all $18. Ended up having to pay the full 18. But it was frustrating because he didn't know that Deontay Johnson was his target. He was just sitting there, like, not really paying attention. And then Deontay Johnson comes up. And he's like, oh, I like that guy. And he starts bidding on him. I'm like, I'm going to have to pay the full 18, aren't I? And sure enough, I had to pay the full 18 bucks. And it frustrated the hell out of me because he just got kind of lucky that somebody nominated him before he could spend a few more bucks. I wouldn't have had to spend all that. So it's frustrating. But, you know, auctions are the way to take that advantage back. And that's why I love them so much.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why people are hesitant to join auctions?
What, because of how the difficulty level?
Because you have to prepare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's something that I don't think people admit to themselves enough, that it is hard work. It's, you got to spend time. I say it on my show all the time. Like, you got to have this sort of desire to want to get better at it, because there are people that I've been auction drafting with for 15 years that do the same thing every year. It's not necessarily bad, but they're always going to do the same thing. There's no curiosity there. I love curious people, people who want to learn, who want to get better, who look at the world around them and don't just like bump into walls as they walk around all day. And auctions are for curious people. And some people that get in them are not curious, and therefore they're not going to succeed as much.
Yeah, you definitely see that, especially, you know, I try to pull some of my buddies into leagues, whether it's a dynasty league or a super flex league, or I have an auction contract league, and, you know, they immediately were like, no, this is too much. This is, you know, and, you know, one of the things that when I first did my first auction, it was actually an auction contract dynasty league. So a little bit over my head, but let's just do it. The draft obviously was chaos and all sorts of fun. But then after the draft, there's just this huge range of different values. And you have sometimes where like, you're like, hey, that's the 8th ranked receiver and that's the 9th ranked receiver. But then you have this guy's $12,000 and this one's $37,000, or we'll say $12 and $37.
Right.
Like, you have those huge ranges of value. So in your dynasty leagues, do you see that a lot? And does that make trading more difficult?
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to put all my cards on the table. I'm in one dynasty league. So I'm in the kitchen sink league with Ryan McDowell and Curtis Patrick and some of these guys. I'm way out of my league in that thing. It is so complicated. So yeah, it's difficult to trade because the max contract that you can have in this league is 4 years. So most people aren't really wanting to trade the stable quarterbacks. It's a super flex. Quarterbacks, top wide receivers, you end up trading around all these guys that are middling assets. It's difficult. It's really difficult. And as far as keepers go, it's the same thing. If you're in a, like, for instance, the keeper league I'm in is a full flex. It's also a best ball. That's a little bit weird. But the point is, it does become difficult to trade thinking about contracts, prices, and team needs, like melding all those three. And I understand that's kind of like the adrenaline for some of the, for dynasty folks. I get that. And that is kind of fun, but it can also be one of the most frustrating things because people just, they don't pay attention. It's like, okay, I got Devontae Adams this year in that league and he's on an expiring contract. Now I'm trying to trade him. And everybody thinks I want a dollar for him. No, I want 60 cents or I want 50 cents for him because I understand he's an expiring contract, but people aren't hooking into that like they should. I think it's a little frustrating, to be honest.
Yep.
Yeah, I find trading in general, I know I always talk about how bad I am at trading on this show, but when I hear salary cap questions, like when I see them come across Twitter, I'm always like, whoa, like, I don't even know if I would even try a trade when I had to figure out all the cap implications. And I did an RSO league right when they started. I don't know if anybody's done a, are they even still around, Reality Sports Online?
Oh, yeah.
And I loved it. And I loved it because I prepared out of my ass for that show, but for the draft. And I just, like, there is no better feeling than going into a draft. And I think that's what, like, I love about auctions, because that, you know, that was an auction, is that when you have all your information in front of you, nothing surprises you at that point, right? Like, if a player's going for less, you're like, oh, well, I'll take that player because I have him budgeted at this amount.
Yeah.
So thinking about that, what would you say is the one thing a fantasy manager must do before their auction?
I think the par sheet is the single biggest piece of information that I want in an auction. And for those who don't know what a par sheet is, it's a phrase I coined. It's not a new concept. I just coined the phrase, but it's basically getting your sheet. And let's say for a typical auction, you're going to draft 16 players and you're going to have 9 starters. You want to go down and put a dollar amount for every single position. And I don't just mean like, oh, okay, 20 to 30 on this guy. No, I want you to say QB1, 13, RB1, 48, RB2, 26. I want you to put a dollar amount on every one. And that helps beginners because it's like bumpers on a bowling lane. You can't really make a huge mistake if you have those numbers in front of you. So when you're in, the example I always like to give is, okay, let's say you said, I'm going to pay $48 for a running back. And then you spent 46. The huge advantage of the par sheet, the reason I like it so much and why I call it the par sheet, is because you're trying to shoot par. You're not, like in golf, trying to be over par or under par. You're trying to exactly hit that 200. And so in order to do that, you have the exact numbers. And then as the auction goes along, your par sheet automatically tells you what to do. And by that, I mean, if you spent 46 on a guy you thought you were going to spend 48 on, you just go out to write on your par sheet and you write +2, because now you're $2 ahead of the game. And every time you buy a player, you adjust that number. And if you get further and further ahead, you realize you can slam that money into one position or sprinkle it down for more depth. But your par sheet tells you exactly what to do. People who don't have that in front of them feel very unsure. Their footing feels weird. Like, okay, well, can I spend this? Or they get too excited. And let's say they spend that 46 on that first running back, and you know, hey, I can only spend 26 on my second. You're not going to make the mistake of being like, oh no, Nick Chubb's only 31. I'm going to pay that. Or, oh no, Austin Eckler is going for 47. That's a good deal. You're not going to do that because it's going to blow your sheet out of the water.
That was exactly going to be my next question is, you know, NFL, like the NFL manages their resources like you would in an auction draft. And, you know, they have so much money and resources devoted to the offensive line and to the running back. So you can see which teams specifically, you know, value certain positions. Warren Sharp put something out. It was very interesting. The number one most expensive offense in the league right now is the Detroit Lions. And I thought that was really interesting. They're 1 million over, I think, the Cowboys. But yeah, that was my question. I mean, obviously not asking for specific numbers, but when you quote unquote budget, do you budget like per like position group?
I don't. In fact, I do the opposite. I budget just per position alone, because I know that a lot of people do like to do positional groups, and I don't think that's bad. I think that if you're a veteran and you know what you're doing, that's okay to be like, all right, I want to spend $80 on running backs or whatever. I think that's fine. But you really, I think you got to know what you're doing in order to do that, because again, you can get caught spending too much and you don't really realize how tight the dollars are. And that's why I love the par sheet, because the dollars, when you go down and you start putting down, I want to pay this and I want to pay this and I want to pay this, then you add it all up and you're like, oh, that's 231. Okay, I'm $31 over. And you realize how scarce the money is. And I don't think you realize that as you're going through a draft. And that's why I feel like I'm always successful at the end of auctions, because I know how tight the dollars are near the end. So it allows me to be more restrained early in the draft. So I'm going for individual price points. And one of the things that I don't like to do is I don't like to have that overall positional number, only because I like to pull from one group to another group as the auction goes on. So mm-hmm. if I'm seeing that the RB2 prices are falling off a cliff, I'm just going to pull some money from my wide receiver three and shove it into my RB2. So I don't want the limitations. I don't want the firewalls there.
Now that's exactly, you know, it makes sense because, you know, let's say you said, oh, I'm going to put $84 into running backs. You think you got $84 to spend. You're getting, you know, Christian, you know, getting Jonathan Taylor, you're spending $64. And next thing you know, you're like, okay, well, my second running back is going to be Keyonte Ingram, right. You know, because I'm broke. And so that makes perfect sense to split it up like that.
So if that's one thing that a fantasy manager must do, what is the one thing, the biggest mistake that you see a rookie manager make in an auction?
The single biggest mistake, I'm going to give you a couple. The single biggest mistake is not spending all your money. And I always caution people like, hey, you can't spend their money. You can't spend your money too soon. But I can predict every year in my home leagues who's going to have money left. They're a little bit nervous about spending a lot of money. They don't get in there early enough, and then they end up throwing a bunch of money at players that don't deserve the money. So spend your money. Don't be a drunken sailor and spending it all in the first third of the auction, but spend your money. That's number one. I think that's the biggest problem. Because let's say a $200 cap, you end up with 11 bucks. That is massive. You might be able to get a wide receiver two that you paid 21. If you throw 11 on that and he's 32, you're getting a top of the line wide receiver two versus a bottom of the line one. That is a huge difference. So that's number one. The second mistake I think that people make too much is they just believe that the only way to nominate players is just by picking the top ranked guy still left on their sheet. They treat it like a draft. Like, oh, okay, well, we've done the top eight guys. Okay, Derrick Henry's number nine. Okay, Derrick Henry. Well, that doesn't do anything for you. My biggest pet peeve is we don't control a lot in auctions. We can't control very much. The one thing we can control is, besides our budget, is our nominations. So nominations should be targeted to accomplish your goal. And just going down and picking that top name on the sheet, it's just a terrible strategy, and it does nothing to advance your draft.
Yeah, I typically nominate players that I don't want because I want you to spend money. And so I'll say, hey, this guy, people are going to like this guy. They're going to want to spend on him. And so I'll nominate him knowing that I'm not going to be stuck with him.
And I don't have a problem with that. So the one thing I always say about that strategy is early in a draft, I want to steer my draft one way or the other. So I'm going to accomplish a couple things before I go to that strategy, Dave. I like that because after like two rounds, I want to know, do I have my RB1? Am I going after Kelsey? Am I going to get him? Am I going after Taylor? Did I get him? Am I going after Cooper Kupp? Did I get, you know, something, whatever. Maybe you want a good quarterback. Point is, nominate those guys early. See if you get them or not. You're not getting a deal on Cooper Kupp, right? So like we can all agree. Just get him out there. See if you're going to land him. And if you don't, then you can go a different direction. And then after that happens, after you have your cornerstone, then start nominating guys you don't want.
Yeah.
Then you're trying to drain the money because you've already got your cornerstones. Now you want them to drain the money. Yeah.
Something diabolical that you brought up on your pod the other week, Drew, which I loved, is you brought up the fact that after somebody lands their RB1, to immediately nominate their backup, right? Nominate their backup. Yeah. And make them not wait until the end when they – you know, they're just messing around and can sign anybody they want, but make them in the heat in the first couple rounds, make the decision whether or not they're going after Tony Pollard or.
Yeah. 100%. I love that strategy. And there's two ways you can play it, because if you think, hey, like I think Zeke's going to be a good deal, you call out Pollard first and see if he's a palatable price. And then if he's not, you can pass on him. And maybe you want to pass on Zeke then, but I love somebody gets Zeke. Pollard's my next nomination 100% of the time, because you don't want to wait until there's no money in the room. You want them to pay for Tony Pollard. He might be $11 early in the middle of a draft when there's still hundreds of dollars floating around, but he might be $3 later. So I want to make that person, if they're going to handcuff, I want to make them do that $11. I know that's brutal, but, and I say it all the time, like, I like the people I'm in these leagues with, but you got to turn that off and you got to be a killer. You got to walk in the draft room and be a killer.
Now, who do you think, in your experience, is the best auction player you've gone against?
I knew that's where this was going when you started the question. That, boy, that's tough, because I don't want to insult anybody. Let's say, first of all, Scott Pianowski is right at the top of the list. I ended up, unfortunately, not because I don't like Scott. In fact, I really like Scott as a person. I was in all kinds of drafts with him last year. It was ridiculous. He was in my Scott Fishbowl league. I was in this fantasy index auction with him. I was in like four or five leagues with him, and he was always drafting like right behind me. Dude is brutal. When I was in the, you're saying you don't remember a whole lot from the Kings Classic auction, but I just remember every time I thought I was getting a deal, Scott Pianowski was there jumping down my throat with a bid.
Riding your bids.
Yeah, he knew. He knew I was about to get a deal, and he would just bid a couple bucks, and then I would end up paying like $4 or $5 more. He did that to me relentlessly. The other guy that I think I always am butting heads with is Steve Rappin over at Fighting Chance. He's an excellent auction drafter. I'm not in the big boys room, but I hear that there's a couple killers in that room too. Jim Coventry, I've never actually done an auction with him except when we did a mock last year. Jim Coventry is a really smart dude, and he absolutely crushed the Jim Brown auction last year. I think he won best record to most total points and then won the title. Oof. Wow. So those are three names. An underrated guy who doesn't get a lot of press, Doug Orth. He sits next to me. He probably doesn't want to sit next to me anymore, but I'm always making jokes, and he's probably trying to pay attention. But Doug's a really underrated guy too. He does high stakes auction stuff. So those are some names that come to mind.
We were lucky enough to get Doug on the pod a few weeks ago. And we talked about trading strategies. We talked about high stakes leagues. He is one of, I think, one of the most underrated people on Twitter, or underrated people in fantasy, just to pick his brain. That dude is smart.
Hyper intelligent guy. Yeah.
And I would say that's the one takeaway I had from observing all of you bidding, was just the level of discourse. Like, in, like when we took a break, like hearing all of you talk and how you approached it, it was rewarding to see, as an aspiring like analyst, just to see how much care and the ability of everybody to execute at a high level. I know there were some things that happened at the fan, like the expo itself, where you were like, oof, like you would watch experts do things and you're just like, huh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Are you really an expert? But yes. I will say at the Kings Classic, there was none of that. Like,
that's a tough room, man. I've never drafted in a room like that before or since. It's just, not only is the fantasy knowledge there, but almost everybody in that room has done an auction at one point or another. And there's no free passes. And it's wild how you just get to a point where I actually got super depressed after my draft in 2020. I mean, I know I went on to win the league, but I got super depressed about how difficult it was. And you just really couldn't get a deal. You couldn't get a great team. And the one thing that it made me depressed all over again, preparing for the 2021 draft, because I'm looking at the prices and I'm like, I can't put together a solid team with these prices. It's not doable. It's not possible to walk in that room and have a solid team top to bottom with the prices that are there. You're going to have holes. That's depressing. Walking into a room knowing I'm going to not like some of these players. And I just got lucky last year with the players I didn't like panning out for me. So
I don't think luck had much to do with it. But thank you for your humbleness. Is appreciated.
So takes a lot of luck to win a fantasy league like that. But your point is well taken. I understand.
The consistency in getting to the playoffs is where the skill comes in. There is always luck in winning the championship. So just to end the pod, I wanted to discuss your day job a little bit. Sure. So how long have you been a male escort?
Well, it's been about 13 years and my prices go up every year. I don't want to leave. So
it's like an auction. Yeah. I have a certain amount budgeted, but I'm not going over it, Drew.
Yeah. I mean, I live in style, you know, I can't get out of the business yet.
So did your analytical mind make you want to be a lawyer from the start, or did something
kind of
spur you into it?
Yeah. So I had two possible career paths, and I got my philosophy degree in college. And my first thought was I'm going to be a philosophy professor. And I got into a high level philosophy class. It was like 380 or something. And it was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. And I said, I can't even get into a 400 level class because I wouldn't pass. So how the hell am I going to teach this? So I threw that in the trash. Not that I didn't want to do it. That stuff's interesting to me. But my brain certainly works a way that makes me want to be a lawyer. And I did debate in high school. I know I'm checking all the cool kid boxes here, but I loved debate. And we had a lot of fun. Believe it or not, I feel like I'm that girl talking about band camp. But we had a blast on these trips. A lot of things happened there that that were a lot of fun and made me realize that, like, hey, I can still be this guy and still be somebody that I like. I like myself when I'm doing this stuff, and it's interesting to me. And I found that I was around curious people. I didn't call it that at the time. I was in high school, but that sort of kept me on that path all along. And lawyers are the same way. They're just thoughtful people for the most part.
And have you always been a criminal defense attorney?
I have. I started out in private practice. I did everything. So I was a jack of all trades. And after a few years, that got to be too much. I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to focus on criminal defense. It's really hard to find a firm that you can do criminal defense because there really aren't big criminal defense firms. There's small ones. So you either wait for the phone to ring in a small firm or you go to the public defender. I went to the public defender and I'm happy there.
Are you still work for the public defender?
Yep. I'm year 18 in about... I guess 6 weeks is my 18 year anniversary.
Wow.
That's a long time.
Thank you. Thank you for your work. I mean, that is a vital cog of our democracy. And I appreciate it.
I appreciate you saying that. It is one heck of a interesting job. When we get together in Canton, get a few beers in me. There's a lot of stories that I'm sure you find interesting. But yeah.
All right. I'm not going to go down a long Deshaun Watson path. I do have one question about Deshaun Watson. The case is now in the hands of the arbitrator. What is the major difference between a civil trial and arbitration?
I don't think there is a huge difference because my understanding of it, and I'm not sure, this is something I was talking with somebody about earlier. I believe that they're using the civil burden of proof here in this case, because you're not going to use the criminal burden of proof, which is the highest level, and you're not going to use probable cause. So I believe that the NFL was working on a preponderance of the evidence type of burden. So I'm not sure there's a huge difference. The one question I had about the hearing was how in-depth it was going to be, because they were only presenting five cases, but I thought, gosh, you know, that could easily last several days. My initial impression was that's just going to be one day because it's not a full evidentiary hearing. I think it turned into a full evidentiary hearing. I don't mean turned into. I think it was supposed to be, and that's what happened. It ended up going 3 days. So I think they had a fairly significant presentation of evidence and arguments there.
Yeah, everything I read about the arbitrator, former federal judge Sue Robinson, she seems to have run a really tight ship. Is her ruling binding?
It is. So the way that it was collectively bargained, and this is something I'm going to give credit to Mike Florio on. I spent a lot of time bashing Mike Florio because I think he's irresponsible in a lot of ways. But he did have an excellent video the other day, and I give him credit for that, explaining the process. So if anybody wants to go find that on his Twitter account, but I'll give you the brief version. When she makes a finding, she will have to put that in a decision. That decision will have a quote finding of fact. What she found to be the facts. And then she'll give a recommendation for her suspension. Now, ultimately, if that suspension is appealed, it goes back to Goodell, which sounds kind of funny, like, what? But he is still bound by the finding of fact. So he can't just be like, oh, just because she didn't find it doesn't mean he didn't do it, and I'm going to slap an extra 8 games on. He does not have that power. He has to still be bound by the decision that she made. Now, she can make a decision and find that he violated the policy and give him 4 games, and Goodell can say, no way, this is 10. This behavior that she found is 10 games. So he can do that, but it has to be backed up by that finding of fact. That's super important.
Makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just wondering if like he could just completely overrule it, but yeah. It does. That makes so much sense that it has to be based upon whatever she finds to be.
And I think this was a big point probably that we didn't pay enough attention to when the CBA was being hammered out last time. The players really wanted this, because before it was just King Goodell doing whatever he wants. Like, hey, this is for the good of the league. Kind of like me running one of my leagues. But they pushed really hard for like, there's got to be some accountability. There has to be this process. And honestly, at this point, I really think that Watson's going to benefit from this process. I think the first test case here is going to go more in his favor than we think.
And does the NFLPA step in? So in a situation where mm-hmm. she finds evidence, she recommends 4 games. Goodell says, no, I'm giving you 8. Does the NFLPA step in? And then you're back into where we're negotiating.
Yeah, but it's not really a negotiation at that point. It's just part of the appeal process. So the NFLPA is going to say, look, there was this type of behavior going on with your, with some of your owners, and this is not an appropriate amount. So I know that the NFLPA still has some recourse, but I don't really believe that we're going to end up in a long, drawn-out legal process. I'm guessing at some point this gets settled prior to Brown's training camp, and if it doesn't, we're going to have a decision. I think we're going to know pretty soon, but honestly, we're looking right in that 6-8 game range, whereas before this hearing started, I was really feeling like a year was coming because I thought the NFL had the nuts. But I don't know if they do, and I think the more I hear, the more I think that it's going to be a little bit shorter than people want it to be.
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree with you. I think it's going to be a lot less than people want.
Yeah.
Especially since they were floating the indefinite.
Yeah.
As of like, what, 2 weeks ago, that all of a sudden that started floating around.
Yeah. Right. And that's kind of one of those things where the NFL, you know that they're putting that out there as a trial balloon. Like, let's see how people receive this. And also, like, that's like when you walk into a negotiation, you're like, the price on the car is $10,000, and you go, I'll give you 4. It's like, wait, what? Like, 4 is not a reasonable offer. So I think that's what the NFL was doing. They were setting it out there as far as they could possibly set the bar so that they could come back and get something reasonable out of it. I said 9-12 in my TikTok a couple weeks ago. I really believe in that 9-12 only because I think the NFL wants to be able to say, we got more than half a season. And it used to be 16. Now 9 is more than half a season. I really believe that. I said 9-12 because I think that they want to be able to hold that up and say, this is what we got.
Well, that makes sense to me. It is now time for tags. That was a great episode. So we're going to just tell the riders where they can find us. Any final thoughts that we have? Drew, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, as you said at the beginning, my writing is over at Football Guys, and I'm putting out a ton of what we're calling salary cap content over there. I know there's a shift in the lingo in the industry now, so look for the salary cap content over there at Football Guys. And then my podcast, of course, is The Auction Brief. Have a lot of fun, a little bit goofy, but we cover a lot of territory, a lot of theory about fantasy football there. And then you can find me on TikTok, Fantasy Football Lawyer, and on Twitter at Drew Davenport FF. Thank you for having me, man.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. Dave, where can they find you?
At Dynasty Dorks, all one word. You can find me also on TikTok, and you can find me on Twitter, Instagram. That's it.
Well, again, thank you to Drew for joining us tonight. Make sure you're following him. Like he said, Drew Davenport FF on Twitter, Fantasy Football Lawyer on TikTok. His pod is top notch. If you liked any of the strategy we were talking about, that pales in comparison to the depth that Drew goes to in his pod. It is vital if you participate in auction drafts. So make sure you're tuning in. Another thank you to Dave for helping put together this week's show. You can find me on Twitter at JJ Wenner. Make sure you're checking out Gridiron Ratings for all of our content. Tune into the Chop Shop on Saturday with special guest me. Jeff and I are going to be breaking down Scott Fishbowl and trying to make some sense of his strategy? I don't know. Four tight ends in the first five rounds. We'll talk about that. And then next week on the Rod Pod, Dave and I are going to welcome the author of the Fantasy Football Black Book, Joe Pisapia, to talk about the RB competitions. So from all of us to all of you, be safe, be well, and as always, boat drinks, my friends, boat drinks. Good night.